I'm Kathleen Goldhar, and I'm the host of a new podcast, Crime Story. Every week, we bring you a different crime, told by the storyteller who knows it best.
You got one witness who can't be found. You got another witness who's murdered.
We couldn't sugarcoat this story.
I was getting calls from Cosby's attorney threatening to sue every day.
Every crime in one way or another is a reflection of who we are as a people, as a city, as a country.
Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hello, I'm Matt Galloway, and this is The Current Podcast.
This tragedy has changed who I am and has taught me some very valuable lessons. It said in suffering, we gain wisdom. I've also gained God. In the quiet hours of myself, I prayed to him about the deep impact this tragedy has had on the families.
I cannot express how much I wish that I had known what was going on with him or what was going to happen, because I absolutely would have done a lot of things differently.
James and Jennifer Crumley addressed the court yesterday. A Michigan judge sentenced them to 10 to 15 years in prison for involuntary manslaughter. Their son, Ethan Crumley, was 15 years old when he killed four students at his high school in 2021. This is the first time in an American school shooting that the parents have been held criminally responsible. The Washington Post's Kim Belware has covered this case and joins us now. Kim, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
This is a wild story. What was it about this case in particular that put the responsibility of the parents for the actions of their son front and center?
Well, like you said, this was a really unprecedented case. And what a lot of people who I spoke to who were involved in this case or were just watching it closely for the precedent it could set pointed out that there were such egregious facts in this case. There was documentation. There was also the proximity of when some of these big catastrophic decisions were made in relation to the actual shooting. We're talking days before the shooting, hours before the shooting, huge decisions that truly could have changed the course of all of this.
Let's walk through those decisions. And the prosecution lays them out in the argument that led to the parents' convictions. Talk about some of them, particularly. We can begin with the actions of the parents, if you'd like.
Right. Well, 4 days before the shooting, that's when the clock really starts. This is when the gun was purchased. This was purchased, you know, it had been discussed as an early Christmas gift. The parents did seem aware that their son was depressed, that he was down. There had been some things in his life that happened that had made him sad. So, you know, they thought this was something that, you know, he could do with one of the parents. This could be a family activity.
So just to be clear, they bought the gun as an early Christmas gift for the son.
For the son, yes. And then a few days after that, the mother buys ammunition for the gun, and she takes the son to a shooting range to practice. Now, she said that this is not something that she would usually do, and she was actually surprised, kind of pleasantly, that her son wanted her to go, and it was because dad, who he usually shot guns with, was busy that day. And then we go to the morning of the shooting, where the parents are called into school because teachers found his math homework where the shooter had drawn really disturbing images of a gun that looked like the one that was just purchased, of a bullet-ridden, bleeding body, words that said things like, the thoughts won't stop, help me, blood everywhere. And so the parents have been called to school to discuss this with their son and a counselor and a dean of students. You know, they all discuss this. And ultimately, it is decided that while the school officials want the parents to take him home, they want to get him help because they, at this point, don't think that he's homicidal. They think he might be suicidal. Mm. So they're more worried about him. The parents, the son asks to stay because he didn't like remote learning during the pandemic. It stressed him out. He said he wanted to stay in school. And the parents said, okay, we got to go back to work. We'll get him help in the next 48 hours. And at no point did anybody at the school or the parents search his backpack. And the parents did not mention in this meeting that he had been sad, that a gun had been purchased, and that he recently had practiced with one.
What did the defense for the parents say, having heard those facts, that there were a number of things the prosecution believes that the parents could have done to interrupt this young man and prevent the school shooting? What did the defense say?
Well, they had said that the things that their son expressed as far as thoughts of being violent and being as badly depressed as he was were not things that they knew of at a level that he had described them in journals or, you know, text messages to his best friend. Because another part of this is that prosecutors, you know, noted that there had been months preceding the shooting where he had written these things, showed signs of mental distress. And the parents said, you know, we didn't read his journals. We didn't read his text messages. So if he talked about shooting a school, we weren't going through his room, you know. And they had a lot of ways to explain away some of the odd behavior when the son texted his mother saying that he was seeing bulls fly around the house and things fly out of the closets. She said that this is a long-running family joke about their 1920s house being haunted. So, you know, they had all of these. And then the parents, they shifted a little bit of blame back and forth, particularly the mother. She said that guns had been her husband's responsibility. She didn't know anything about them. And when it comes to locking them up, that was on him to do. Now, the dad said, I did lock up the gun. The gun was in a case. It was in my in our bedroom, and it was hidden in an armoire, and the ammunition was hidden separately. And the gun was locked, but as prosecutors had pointed out, the gun lock was on the default code of 000, so it would have been easy to get into. And you know, ultimately, we know that he did get into it.
In sentencing these parents to prison for 10 to 15 years for involuntary manslaughter, what did the judge say in that sentencing?
Well, the judge really said, you know, that it was, again, the facts. It was the facts of this case were so egregious. They showed so much negligence that this is a sentence that deserved to go, you know, kind of above what, you know, she might normally give. You know, they had some things working in their favor in that, you know, they didn't have extensive criminal histories. That always kind of brings down what a potential sentence could be. But you could also tell that Judge Cheryl Matthews seemed rather irritated because both James and Jennifer Crumbley did speak at the sentencing hearing as well. And they expressed remorse. They expressed regret. They said that they were sorry to the families and said that they, you know, wished that they could have, you know, taken this back. But there just wasn't the fulsome owning of accountability that I think the judge would have wanted to see.
Well, she had said, I mean, Jennifer Crumbley had said, is this not correct in past that she wouldn't have done anything differently?
Yeah. And that is an interesting point because she was asked on the stand, you know, would you have done anything differently? And she said, no, I wouldn't. And that was something that the jury foreperson in her case said really kind of poisoned her for the jury. And that's something that the families brought up. It is important to note, though, that foreseeability, saying I knew this was going to happen, was a key part that the prosecutors had to prove. Jennifer Crumbley plans to appeal. So if she did say on the stand, yes, I saw he was a danger and I would have done something differently, she would have played into the prosecutor's argument. So this was, you know, an understanding that the parents are likely to appeal. They were a little bit tied. They can't be as fully human if it was in their heart to really own this and really express remorse. They kind of can't because they're going to try and get a redo on this case.
The parents of the victims of this school shooting also made victim impact statements. Have a listen to some of them.
You show no remorse, no respect, or compassion for our family. The same traits that you've bestowed upon your son. The traits that you have torn my family into pieces. The lack of compassion that you have shown is outright disgusting. Not only did your son kill my daughter, but you both did as well.
One of the reasons why this case stands out, it sounds obvious in some ways, but is that in the litany of mass shootings and school shootings, this is the first time that parents in an American school shooting, as I said, have been held criminally responsible for the actions of their child. You wrote in your piece that this judgment reshaped attitudes around parental liability cases when children access a gun to hurt others. How has this reshaped those thoughts?
So this case has really provided a framework for how other prosecutors, if they are faced with a similar situation, that they can try this. And we saw this in Lake County, Illinois, just outside of Chicago. The man who carried out the Highland Park shooting on 4th of July 2 years ago, his father helped him get the weapon when he was underage. He carried out the shooting when he was an adult, but the father later pleaded guilty to a misdemeanor weapons charge. And that this prosecutor has been talking with the Oakland County prosecutor. And there's also, you know, in Newport News, Virginia recently, a school official was held accountable for security failures and kind of not taking it seriously. And this is coming along at a particular moment, too, where now we have so much technology and we have unfortunately had so many school shootings and so many mass shootings. If you're a parent, if you're a school administrator, then maybe 20 years ago, you could say, I had no idea that, you know, this could happen. But now there's so much information out there that they have less of an excuse. And prosecutors are saying, maybe this is a way to expand accountability.
So is your sense, just finally, in the reporting that you've done, and I know that you spoke with other people in the justice system, if I can put it that way, is your sense that this could set a precedent, that other people could be held accountable for the actions of those close to them if they knew that those actions perhaps were going to unfold and that they could have done something to stop that shooting?
I do. But I do think that the bar will remain very, very high. And again, you know, the facts in this case were just so extraordinary, in a sense, for anybody who thinks that there's going to be rampant over-prosecution of parents now for anything their kids do wrong. I think those kind of defending the Oxford prosecution would say, unless they have such extraordinary facts, like in the Crumbly case, that's not likely.
I don't know if anybody's talking about over-prosecution. I think people might be talking about the fact that this might slow down the avalanche of mass shootings because other people would be held responsible.
Yes, that's even something that the judge said, is that, you know, she's thinking of deterrence, and that's something that people hope come of this particular prosecution.
This is really interesting. People certainly in the United States, but well beyond, are watching this closely. Kim, thanks for walking us through it.
Thank you for having me.
Kim Belware is a breaking news reporter for The Washington Post.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.